Beyond our imagination, God is so great, and His love for us is so great, and how good it has been for us to bask in God's greatness and in His love this morning. Thank you for being here and your contribution to this assembly, and we thank all four of our good brothers for leading us in such an apt way this morning. I heard about this study a good while ago and recently finally did a little research and uncovered the details of it. And I want you to listen to this brief excerpt from an article from the BBC entitled "Choir Singers Synchronize Their Heartbeats." Choir singers not only harmonize their voices, they also synchronize their heartbeats, a study suggests. Researchers in Sweden monitored the heart rates of singers as they performed a variety of choral work. They found that as the members sang in unison, their pulses began to speed up and slow down at the same rate. Writing in the journal Frontiers in Psychology, the scientists believe the synchrony occurs because the singers coordinate their breathing. Dr. Bjorn Wyckoff from the Sahlgrenska Academy at Gothenburg University in Sweden said, "The pulse goes down when you exhale, and when you inhale, it goes up. So when you're singing, you are singing on the air when you are exhaling, so the heart rate would go down. And when the phrases, and between the phrases, you have to inhale and the pulse will go up. If this is so, then heart rate would follow the structure of the song and phrases. And this is what we measured, and this is what we confirmed." Did you know that was what was happening this morning? That it was not just our voices that were working as one in our congregational singing. Our hearts were beating as one. Wow. This is the second lesson in a two-part series on our public worship. One God, one heart, one voice. Now you sort of understand why that title is there. What God wanted Israel to know, and Israel was the prototype of the church, what God wanted Israel to know from the beginning was about His oneness. Deuteronomy 6, verse 4, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your might." It's the first truth. And Jesus extends this, reflecting on His relationship being one with the Father, which I think is reflected in Deuteronomy 6. Jesus says this about Himself, His Father, and His followers in John 17 and verse 20 in the prayer the night that He was betrayed. "I do not ask for these only, but also for those who will believe in Me through their word," the word of the apostles, "that they may all be one, just as You, Father, are in Me and I in You, so that they also may be in Us, so that the world may believe that You have sent Me." God is one. He wants His people to be one. And He wants His people to be one with Him. And one of the ways that we manifest that as God's people is that we assemble together to see and encounter the one God, and to do that as a united people. And there are so many statements in the Psalms that emphasize the importance of private worship to God, of thinking about God and praying to Him and praising Him and thanking Him. There is also a lot about doing it as His people, such as Psalm 35, verse 18. "I will thank You in the great congregation. In the mighty throng, I will praise You." there's the I, but doing it as a we, together, praising God with one voice, and thanks to the Swedes, shall we say, one heartbeat. In the Old Testament and the New Testament and in eternity, God wants his people to encounter him and worship him in the assembly. God's will is that we gather, and we gather as a people so that we can experience him and see him together. Well, so now that we've established that in the whole lesson last week and in that little review right then what should that mean? I left you with four questions last week that now we want to explore one at a time. First of all, do I see that our assembly is about seeing God? You know, think about it. We've all done this. We're like, okay, I'm getting ready to come to the assembly on Sunday morning, and oh, I need to talk to Ray Conies about something. Or I've got something to give Linda Smith, or probably she's got something to give me. Probably is how that usually works. And we think about somebody we're going to see and do something for or talk to, and that's appropriate. Hebrews 10:25, describing our assembling of ourselves together to stimulate or stir up one another to loving good works. We should think about our brothers and sisters and seeing one another and interacting with each other. But foremost, do we think about meeting God? Do we think, first of all, I'm going to see God? I'm going to meet God. I'm going to listen to God. At the end of the, toward the end of Matthew's gospel, in Matthew chapter 18, Jesus makes a statement there. It's found in an unusual place. It's similar to the statement made at the end of the gospels, but here Jesus is giving directions about what to do when there is a sinful, unrepentant brother among the believers, and there are stages in dealing with that person and trying to reason with them, but then there's finally a cutting off. But this is a statement that he makes regarding their working together as one. He says in Matthew 18, verse 20, "For where two or three are gathered in my name, there I am among them." Now, I'm not saying that the assembly, like right now, is the only manifestation of this, but it's at least one manifestation of it. We're gathered in the name of Christ, honoring Christ, and he's among us. It's not that he is literally present, physically present. He has ascended to the Father and sits at the right hand, ruling. But by faith, we see him, we experience him, we're connected to him. And in that way, he is among us. And I want you to consider how that awareness of Christ before us, of the Father, the Son, and the Spirit, of deity before us and experiencing deity, that it really keeps us on track. Consider the statement made in Hebrews 12. And this is at the end of that section we read at the end last week, where the writer is trying to encourage these Hebrew Christians by depicting the heavenly worship scene in a very magnificent way, this glorious gathering before God. And then at the end of that chapter, look what he says in verse 28. "Therefore, let us be grateful for receiving a kingdom that cannot be shaken, and thus let us offer to God acceptable worship with reverence and awe." Before, there is this heavenly scene depicted, which is happening now, and will one day we will experience it. But this is a statement made about the present. Since we're in the kingdom of God now, let us do what? Let us, group, congregation, offer to God acceptable worship with reverence and awe. It's so important that our worship is acceptable to God. It's not enough just to be excited and sincere about your worship. That's not the first question. The first question is your worship acceptable to God? Because worship that is not acceptable to God is empty. We want to do and worship what pleases Him. That's why we do what He's taught us, what He's spoken and told us to do. You know what worship does? Worship sets the tone, or should set the tone, for the rest of our lives. It's like when a song leader gets up and he pitches a note to start a song. That pitching of that note, quote, sets the tone. There's nothing better setting the tone for how we should live our lives on Tuesday morning or Thursday afternoon or Friday night than to regularly assemble with God's people and worship, and it sort of just calibrates everything. It reorientates everything. And we see God, we're aware of Him, we're aware of what He wants from us. And as a result, that keeps us on track, which is why it's so important that our assemblies do not slowly morph into something else. A feel-good session, a fun session, a session of philosophizing, a session of just storytelling. It's always got to be focused on God, because that's when we focus on Him, we keep ourselves focused and on track. So do I see that our assembly is about singing God? That's why we gather here. And working from that, the second question that I posed last week is, do I value the assembly for that reason, meeting God? Think about the different ways that we meet someone. We talk in a formal way about appointments. We talk in an informal way about getting up with someone or even bumping into someone. Once you think about the different connotations with that, think about getting with a casual friend. Think about meeting up with your best friend. The difference there. Think about seeing and meeting a relative, a distant relative, maybe at a family reunion, versus traveling 400 miles to go visit a relative and stay with them at their house for a whole week. It's different, isn't it? There's a meeting with a coworker versus a meeting with the CEO of the company. And you may have a conversation in the street with your HOA president or your council member if you're in a town, versus being invited to go meet with the governor of the state. I want you to think about all those different meetings and what they communicate. How seriously do you take the meeting? I mean, if you're going to get with a casual friend, something may happen and you may call him up and say, hey, I can't get with you today. You're probably not going to do that to the governor. You're probably not going to do that. How much effort do you exert to make sure it's the right time and the right place? Do you show up with anticipation? I mean, some of those meetings, you'll even give it a thought. You know, what's this going to be like? What am I going to say? What are they going to say? What are we going to do? You don't do that. But some meetings, some appointments, you're like, oh, what are we going to talk about? What's this going to be about? What's the purpose of this? You really put a lot of thought to it, and you're really anticipating it. Well, now you get the point. There is a scale of value to meetings. We learned last week from the Old Testament that a common expression for the tabernacle, the centerpiece of worship for the Israelites, was tent of meeting. The tent of meeting. What meeting? Between God and Israel. And what was the tabernacle used for in this meeting? Yeah, worship. And meeting whom? Meeting God. It's not, oh, the meeting of us Israelites. It's the meeting of God. Could just anybody approach that tent anytime, anyway, for any purpose? No. It was holy. And so is our assembly. And so is our tabernacle or temple. Look at the statement by the Apostle Peter in his first letter in the second chapter that is depicting who we are and thus what we do. In verse 5, he says to these followers of Christ, "You yourselves, like living stones, are being built up as a spiritual house." Stop right there. The churches, it was a group of churches in northern Asia Minor that Peter was writing to. It's pretty clear from several different pieces of evidence in the New Testament. These were Jewish Christians, or predominantly Jewish Christians. So when he writes to them, "You are like living stones making up a spiritual house," of course they think of the temple of Solomon, and then, you know, the second temple that was built for the New Testament era. But Peter says, "You're the living stones that make up a spiritual house." And he makes it clear here, it's a spiritual house. It's not a physical one. For what purpose? To be a holy priesthood. See, these were the people in the Old Testament who brought the worship to God at the tabernacle and the temple to offer up spiritual sacrifices, not the blood of bulls and goats, but spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Jesus Christ. That is a wonderful verse, a wonderful statement that summarizes who we are and what we do. We are living stones that God is putting together to create this spiritual house for worship of Him through Christ. This is the church. And this is who we are and what we do as His assembly, His congregation. It's not this pile of timbers and block. This is not a fit house for God. God has the most precious material for His house. It's the saved souls, the people who have been cleansed by the holy blood, the precious blood of Jesus, who are now dedicated to follow Jesus Christ and worship God through Him. That's His holy tabernacle, temple, house for worship. It's us. The house is not a place. It's not a it. It's a who. And it's us. We are that fitting house. And what do? Offer up spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Jesus Christ. So when we assemble, we have a meeting with God. We have an appointment with God. You know, you have a calendar. Maybe you have a paper calendar, or you use your phone or a tablet to keep up with your calendar. And you're like, got this meeting here, got this appointment there. This is the appointment for the week. This is the meeting for the week. This is the gathering for the week. You know why? Because of who we meet. God. Do I value the assembly for that meeting? Meeting with God. And here's the third question. Am I working at engaging with God at the assembly? It may sound unnecessary to emphasize that our worship assembly is about God, but now we begin to see the practical reason why it's got to be at the basis. If we see that we're meeting God here, and we're seeing Him and experiencing Him and tasting Him in worship, then how much effort do we make at the assembly? In the assembly. And I appreciate Rick's comments. They just dovetail really well with this. It's not like a doctor's appointment. You know what you got to do for a doctor's appointment? You just show up. And they do the stuff to you. Gouge you, poke you, look at you, ask you things. You just show up. What about a mandatory meeting at work, a compliance meeting? Oh, that's fun. You just show up. You just endure it. You just sit there. It's not like attending a sporting event or a musical performance. In those settings, you're there passively. And you come with an expectation, though, that the participants, that the leaders, the players on the court or the field or the performers on the stage, that they're there to get your attention and to amuse you and distract you and to somehow entertain you. It's not that at all. That's a passive experience where you're expecting those who are the participants in front of everybody to pull it all for everybody, and you've got this expectation they should do this and do that, and boy, that was not the way it should have been done, and that was... No, it's not that at all. Worship is a verb, which means it's an action. It's an act of seeing and meeting God. And the natural thing that happens when you see and you meet God, you thank Him, you praise Him, you worship Him. And though we may sit and occasionally stand, our minds should be moving. We need to be working on focusing on God. And so here it comes. Let's just talk about it. Let's just lay it out, okay? Here comes the common excuse or the common dilemma or the obstacle that everybody encounters in a worship assembly. I had no idea who was leading in the assemblies today. I didn't confer with them, didn't give them anything. Zachary wanted to know what I was talking about. I said, what's the second lesson about worship assemblies? So he picked some good songs about praise worship. And it was like an excellent leadership this morning. I'm just going to say that. It sounds like I'm trying to pad something, but I'm not. I just let it happen, whatever happened today. Okay, but it was well done, all four of the brothers. You know that. But you know, we're human beings. And the things that happen in a worship assembly, it's not like a well-oiled machine. It's not. It's human beings. And so here's the obstacle for people. The singing may not be very good some morning. The leader's not hitting the right note. Nobody's singing out. The man praying is rambling or mumbling. You can't follow what the man's saying at the Lord's Supper. It's complicated, and you know where he's going with this. And I don't think he knows where he's going. And then there's the sermon. And you know what can happen there. It's an own unique kind of train wreck sometimes. We've all been in that situation. I've never been part of a church, and I've been involved in a lot of different churches where those things don't happen. It's just the way it is. Now, with that said, men should do their best to lead in worship. They should think about how to help the congregation worship. So important. We'll get to that in a minute. However, the real responsibility is on me, the worshiper. That's where the real work is done. I do it as a worshiper. No one does it for me. I want you to think for a moment about sunscreen. When do you use sunscreen? Use it on a hot, sunny day, right? You don't have to put it on when it's cloudy, right? Wrong. Go look up a good dermatology website. According to dermatologists and scientists who supply them their data, 80% of UV rays still come through the clouds. UV rays still come through the clouds. Why am I talking about sunscreen and sun? In so many places, like Psalm 118, we're told that the Lord is God and He has made His light to shine upon us. Can you block the light of God? Of course not. Regardless of the leadership in the worship, God is still there. He still shines through. Things may get a little cloudy every now and then, but He's still there. And if you work to detect His light, you'll see it. No matter how that sermon is delivered. Which brings us to that fourth question. As a worship leader. So I want us to talk about this. As a worship leader, is this my focus? Helping other people see God. Is this my task? Do I understand and embrace that as my task? Again, as a leader in worship, you need to do the best job you can do. And if you can't do the job, then in helping the church, then let someone else do it. You've heard me say this, and maybe I say it publicly sometimes so that I commit myself to it. There's going to come a time in my life where I need to sit down and shut up. No matter how hard it might be, I need to sit down and shut up because I'm not helping. And if you want to weigh in on that when that needs to be, go ahead, I'm listening. But what matters is not what I get to do. What matters is not what I like to do. I like doing this. I want a turn doing that. They get to do it, I want a turn. You're missing it. The point of it all is service. That's the point of it all. But I want you to understand that there's something ironic here. It's usually not when a man who has a lack in skill that there's a problem in leading in worship. There's just something about worshiping God that if a man gets up and leads a prayer or makes statements at the supper or lead songs, and that man is sincere and a humble servant, the worship is still the worship. Ironically, usually the bigger problem is when a man is good at what he does. He may actually be good at it, or he may think he's good at it, because some sweet sister years ago came up and complimented him because she wanted to encourage him. And he took that statement and a couple of others, and he thinks he's great at that. He may or may not be great at it. But when he is good at it, or he thinks he's good at it, there is a tendency to want to show his talent, to show people what he can do and how good he is at it, to show people what he knows and what he's learned and what insights he's got. He wants to enlighten other people because he sees things they don't see. Without realizing it, it becomes about him. It's not about God. It's about what he gets to do in front of everybody. And this is evident when a man, sometimes it happens very subtly, he doesn't use the Bible when he gets up. He has himself as the platform. He's the platform, not the scriptures. It happens when a man's message is long on his own insights and short on divine revelation and teaching. It happens when a man talks a lot about himself. It happens when a man draws attention to himself. And so, if you're good at leading in worship, or you think you're good at leading in worship, take heed. Take heed that it's not become about you. Focus on serving the congregation and helping them worship God. Draw attention to God, not self. Do you remember 2 years ago when we read through the Gospels and certain parts of the New Testament and we really focused on the life and the teachings of Jesus? Then we use this text as our theme. It was the last week in Jerusalem, and Jesus was just a short time away from his crucifixion, and there were Greeks at Jerusalem for the Passover. These would have been devout Greeks seeking the one true God, leaving paganism. And they find Philip, one of the apostles, and they said to him, "Sir, we wish to see Jesus." They wanted to meet Jesus. When you stand to lead in worship, remember this passage. Imagine that you're in front of a group of people who have one driving request. "Sir, we wish to see Jesus." Because you see, as Jesus said a couple of chapters after this part in John's gospel, if you've seen him, you've seen the Father. People want to see God. Point them to God. Talk about God. Focus them on God. You know, it's a mean, cruel world out there. And the reason why, because it cares nothing for God. But look what we get to do. We get to escape that. We have a haven, a safe harbor. We get to come together as one, join our voices, minds, and hearts, and heartbeats, and lift up in one voice worship to God. The only God, the one true living God. And it's a foretaste. Because there's coming a day, a great day, when human beings from all across time who have been those who have had faith in God, who will have an opportunity to experience the most spectacular, exhilarating, and fulfilling event, the assembly of all of God's people in his heavenly tabernacle before his glorious throne. You know what's happening right now? There's a filtering taking place. And it's a filtering about worship. Those who will experience that glory one day are those who gather on a regular basis, because it's so valuable to them to meet God. Though we do these really simple things, there's nothing glitzy about it, nothing fancy about it. And that's why so many religious people want to tinker with it. They want to jazz it up. But there's a filtering going on. Will people follow the simple teaching of God in the Bible and do the simple things he calls us to do, to gather and to pray to him, to honor and remember his son in the Lord's Supper, the simple eating and drinking, to sing praises to him and exhort one another in song, and to encounter God by listening to his word and imbibing that written revelation that he has given us so we can see him and what he's done. We do these simple things to honor God the way he wants to be honored now. And it's those people who do that with sincere hearts who will be invited to the great assembly. The assembly of worship that will last forever. That's indescribable. Zachary's got another song for us to sing together. And I didn't know he was going to pick this one. But he picked a humdinger. Because it's a song about that foretaste. And so as Zachary leads us, let us stand and worship God.